Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is We Talk Productions, one of the few owned black radio networks that explore solutions to issues concerning the black community. Presents Black Urban America. The call-in number for you guys that are listening by laptop, you may call in and express your comments or ask a question. The call-in number is 516-531-9540 and press 1. The lineup, as usual, are Tuesday. We have Black Urban America. I'm your host. My name is Kenny Jones. On Wednesday, we have The Cutting Edge with Michonne Williams. And Thursday, we have Port of Harlem with Way A. Young. And Saturdays, we have Provocative Thought with Carter Steed. All programs begin at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. What should be our roadmap to liberation and freedom? Angela Davis, Jane Cortez, Frances Deal, some of the 20th century divas that are focused on decolonizing our minds. With us tonight is an author that wrote Writing the Black Revolutionary Diva, Women's Subjectivity and Decolonizing Text. Also, she's author Incarnegro Stances, Cross-Racial Espionage in Contemporary Literature and Film, and also Through Ebony Eyes, a Black Feminist and Ethical Praxis of Viewing Contemporary Film. She's an author and professor of Virginia Commonwealth. As a guest is Dr. Kimberly N. Brown. Welcome to the show, Dr. Brown. How are you this evening?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Good. Let me ask you, is Black subjectivity still needed for public expression? And if so, why?
I don't know that you can express yourself without having a black subjectivity. So black subjectivity simply means it's a different way of talking about your identity as a black person. And subjectivity is used instead of the word identity because identity kind of communicates that your identity is fixed, it's like stagnant, it doesn't really like change. But subjectivity takes into consideration how your performance of yourself and your performance of your identity changes depending on who you're interacting with, right? Like, so I'm different with my students, I'm different with my parents, I'm different with my significant others. So, I mean, that's really what subjectivity means in general. So you can't really get away from having it. So, of course, it definitely is necessary.
Okay. And it's all about engaging and communication, huh?
It's all about sort of like to understand that you're not always the same person, like depending on who you interact with. So like your idea of yourself and people's perceptions of you shift depending on the company that you keep, your audience, if we're talking about writers.
Right. Okay. What are your thoughts about how blacks are engaging in the political realm and the intellectual realm?
Can you give me a little bit more specifics of what it is that you're interested in, where that's concerned? Because I'm actually trained as an English scholar.
Are we going politically? Are we going in the right direction? Economically, are we going in the right direction? Are we functioning under the directive? Or are we functioning under the directive of white perception? Or are we going in the direction of, as we call it, being Afrocentric as a collective?
I think that there have always, as long as there have been black people in this country, there's always been a strain of people working against the white gaze, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you're asking me, like, what I think about this particular political moment, I mean, I think we're going to hell in a handbasket, you know. So this is, I mean, a very sort of bleak time, right? I'm sorry to be that blunt about it.
I agree totally. But however, whenever I have politicians on, I always ask them, do we need an African-American agenda? Why are we selling our votes short and what have you? Why are we just doing the same? Why are we doing political insanity?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that I have, like, my own sort of ideas about that. But I think that the optimism that I had when I first wrote Writing the Black Revolutionary Diva isn't the same anymore.
Why not?
I get
we still have barriers and challenges, racism, discriminations, and we still it's unbalanced and dysfunctioning. Why are we still having that same roadmap as Black revolutionaries? Or revolutionary thinking, or revolutionary behavior.
Well, I think that, again, like, we've always had strands of Black resistance to white supremacy from the very beginning. I think that what makes this contemporary moment so challenging is because I think that I didn't anticipate their arrival of 45 and the dismantling of our basic sort of democracy, right? Like, so in a lot of ways, my students are very nervous about the future, and they're nervous about the future because they don't know what to expect. They don't have any faith in the judicial system. They probably never had that. They don't have any faith in voting. They don't have any faith in the press anymore. And all these things are relatively new phenomenon. Like, I can see how we get here, but I don't have the same sort of optimism. The kind of things that I took for granted are being rolled back and up for debate again. You know, I never thought that we'd be debating, you know, abortion laws again, for example. You know, I never thought that mm-hmm. we'd be revisiting rape laws. Like, so there are a lot of things that are, you know, a sticky wicket. And I'm just trying to wait out to see what's going to happen after these 4 years because I don't know that we've been doing anything in the public realm as Democrats or progressives that serve as a sort of challenge to this uprising of white supremacy that we see in this country.
Well, I feel Black folks
so I don't
are falling asleep again.
Battle that.
Yeah, I feel Black folks are falling asleep again. Press one if you have a comment or a question. Of course, African Americans has been colonized for 500 years. How do we decolonize our minds socially, political, and economically?
Well, I think that I think we should back up a little bit, right? Like, so I'm not really like a political scholar. I'm like an English scholar, right? Like, so my book really deals with how African American women use their novels, their public personas, to model for people how to sort of overcome racism, how to overcome double consciousness, things like that, right? And so I'm looking
What would the sisters that you write about, like Angela Davis, Jane Cortez, and them, what would they say how to decolonize ourselves?
Well, I think that what I focus on in my book is the fact that these women are coming out of the Black Arts Movement that happened in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, if we give like a rough estimate of like around 1965 1975, so in a very short sort of period of time, right? And so
right.
that what you see developing is sort of like a black nationalist feminism. You know, this is prior to womanism being coined even. And what they're doing is they're trying to sort of carve out spaces where black women can learn through, like, reading literature or through their own sort of, like for a person like Angela Davis, for her own, like, public persona, how to sort of, like, navigate these particular things, right? So when you have to navigate sexism and racism simultaneously. So some of the things I talk about in the book is the way that the Black Arts Movement or the Black Aesthetic Movement, however you want to speak to it, paves the way for rethinking our position to whiteness, right? So if you're a writer, you know, there's a whole sort of history of writing where black authors have to take into consideration white audiences and what their expectations of blackness are, right? And so when you get to the Black Aesthetic Movement, that dialectic or connection between the black artist, excuse me, the black author and, well, you can say artist as well, black artists and whites are kind of severed and people become more interested in speaking to black people, right? And so some
right.
of that means like decentering whiteness as like the focal point of your audience, right? And so you're writing for an audience that looks more like you. It could also mean speaking truth to power in terms of articulating black rage rather than mitigating black rage so that you don't hurt white people's feelings. It's about also like the idea of like collective unmasking where you're not putting on like a mask of subservience to get along with white people. So there's a myriad of things.
Should we
worry
about that? Should we worry about that?
Say what now?
How we get along? Should we worry about that? How we get along with white folks? Or should we focus on and concentrate on our own liberations and challenges, what we have to do as a collective? I mean, individually, a lot of us are doing very well, but as a collective, you know, should we always worry about how we got to engage the other culture instead of doing what we have to do in order to succeed as a collective?
I think that it's impossible to not have to worry about white people to a certain extent because you have to understand what you're fighting against. Like, so for example, we have like this whole made up fight against critical race theory right now where I promise you, like, this is like a straw man so that people can really come at educators on all fronts for teaching the truth about American history, right? So if you are a race scholar, regardless of color, you're kind of under siege now because people don't want to hear bad stuff about our nation's founding or anything that puts white people in a bad light. And so, like, you have to be vigilant against these particular sort of attacks because, you know, you have to guard yourself against them, particularly if you're an educator. And you saying the right thing, which would be perceived as the wrong thing, might cost you your job, right? Even if we understand the reality is that very few people are teaching critical race theory in the elementary, junior high, or high school level even. So it's just a silly kind of discussion. But if your overall idea is about, like, you know, should you conform and should you change your personality, should you try to do X, Y, and Z to appease white people, I think that we have, like, a whole sort of history of thinking through black resistance where people are trying all sorts of things, right? Like, so they can kill you in a business suit the way they can kill you in a hoodie. So I don't know that trying to kind of capitulate to white ideas of good blackness will get you anywhere anyway. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
I don't know if
yes. The Black Arts Movement. Do they coincide with the Black Liberation Movement? Are they like brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
And how so?
Yeah, I think, well,
what
would
you call the black
happened,
aesthetics? I'm just going to say black arts movement.
Yeah. Well, if that makes you, if you're more comfortable with that verbiage,
yes,
you know, have at it. Yeah, so like the black
and
liberation.
You know what? And the black, in my opinion, the Blacks art movement has always been in the forefront. And even still alive today, East Oakland, Houston, Charlotte, North Carolina. I had some artists on here like for 4 months in a row, once a month, last year. And I mean this year. And they're murals and paintings, sculptures, exhibits our lifestyle. I should say.
I think that's true. I think that you always have black artists and writers at the vanguard of lots of movements. When I'm talking about the black arts movement or the black aesthetic movement more specifically, I'm talking about like a particular period of time. And so to ask me whether or not it coincides with the Black Liberation Movement, I think of the Black Liberation Movement as an umbrella term to explain black resistance during the 60s in general.
Right.
And then you have things that like spoke out from that, like if you're talking about like a wheel. Like, so you see that, you know, at the same time that you might have integrationist politics happening, you see things happening with the Nation of Islam. You see black nationalist politics resurging, black power, and the black arts movement dovetails with all of that. You know, you even see that in basic, like, popular music with things like James Brown talking about I'm black and I'm proud. You see sort of like a whole sort of redefinition of what blackness is and a pride for that. And you also see a shift from people perhaps molding black resistance as perhaps a bourgeois or middle class endeavor, and it becomes something that's taken up by the working class or the masses, right? Like, so there's a lot of I think that that's a really sort of important movement to look at and an important time period to look at. To talk about how redefinition
I agree. The late 60s, that time period, which you specified, 1965 to 1975, a lot of things, a lot of major events were going on in our culture, whether politically, socially, and then we are trying to establish coming out the 60s, I believe we're trying to establish identity, who we are, where we want to go, what we want to do. And then all of a sudden, it just stopped thanks to the crack epidemic of the 80s. We were trying as collective from the 65 to 75 to with these different movements going on. We were trying to find ourselves, and I think that we're trying to find ourselves again, but we still have these barriers and challenges that we have to address as a collective.
What do you think those barriers are? I said, what do you think those barriers are?
Education. Black economics, our political thinking process, our social conditioning, our assimilation to try to be like other cultures, not trying to conform into what we call Afrocentric thought, you know, Afrocentric thought being a part of our daily routine, our daily lifestyle, having our messages channeled down to what you call the masses, the everyday working man, the everyday family. Matter of fact, later on in about 20 minutes, I'm going to ask you about how can the regular folk, and because I'm on the front lines, and mm-hmm. I deal with my folks on a daily basis, face to face, and I'm going to ask you in a little while, how can we get the everyday person to think about this liberation process instead of trying to survive? That's another challenge, trying to survive in a system mm-hmm. that's really not conducive for our well-being, but we still have to do different behaviors to survive in the system, if you follow me.
I am.
And speaking of collective and the behaviors, what should our visions be? And you notice I don't as an individual, even though as an individual you gotta work on yourself, then your family, then your community, then the collective. But as a collective, what should our vision include in our liberation? And what should our liberation be? What should it look like?
Why don't you just ask me next how to end racism? Because I feel like these are some hard-ass questions to ask.
Right? Oh, well, Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown. We ain't never going to end. I'm sorry to inform people. And I always get jumped down. I always get jumped on. We're never going to end racism. We're not going to end discrimination.
I'm just trying to communicate. Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I'm just trying to communicate that you're asking me some hard questions. So I'm going to take a stab at it. But,
these are questions I'm getting from your book, from your articles.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So I've already answered these somewhere. Get that.
Yeah. You already answered. These questions. You already answered these questions.
Well, I mean, I think that the thing that you were talking about earlier in terms of like it beginning with yourself and then reverberating outwards, I think is a good place to sort of start, right? Because so the first thing that you said before was the idea of, like, you know, education, right? But, like, sometimes if you have the wrong education, that works against
having no education.
I always tell
the teachers that come on the show, the educators that come on the show, the principals, how come, well, all in 2022, we got all these black teachers in America, black principals, black superintendents of education, commissioners of education. How come in predominantly black neighborhoods and in our schools, we still have the same type of public educational system that are not teaching our children? How come there haven't been an effort? At one time, it was an effort. How come it hasn't been an effort in the last 25 years to change the educational system from Eurocentric to Afrocentric to a STEM curriculum with entrepreneurship training?
Well, there are schools there are independent black schools that do things like that. So it's not that.
Yeah, one out of a thousand. One out of a thousand?
But think about what you're asking, right? You know, like, so you're
asking
a public school.
I'm asking something that simple. How come you can't teach a curriculum that's going to teach a kid at 6 years old how to think for himself, who he is, you know, what the other cultures
do?
They just start teaching their children at 3 years old about business.
Okay. So I can't speak to what Asians are doing, so I don't deal in generalizations. I don't know what's going on there. But if you're talking about relying on a public school education to be of service to black people, You know, like, I don't know how that works because they're really in service to the state, right? And a lot of the ways that we talk about education in this country is about managing people. It's about thinking about students as, like, empty receptacles. They're all sort of outmoded ways of talking about education that don't really function or foster critical thinking, all right? And so I feel like, you know, irrespective if we're talking about Afrocentric curriculum or any curriculum that really is vested in critical thinking, you know, is doing a lot towards thinking about, like, the liberation of people, right? So, like, all of the people, if you think about all the people who are really into thinking about, like, students and precarity and thinking through, like, how critical thinking can give you, like, a pathway towards freedom or a pathway towards resistance and a pathway or a blueprint of fighting white supremacy, you know, like, that's really where things lie, right? And so even when schools are black-led, if critical thinking is not at the forefront of that, and then what people are really trying to do is manage people and then focus on students who stand out, who seem to be, like, exceptional, rather than thinking about how you can service a wider group of people. You know, like, so, like, you don't get to, like, some people, if you're lucky, you can be, like, exceptional, right? But, like, you can teach people how to think critically.
Right.
But we don't really, we're not vested in that, by and large, in public education because we want to control people. You know, you want to have a population that you can control and predict their movements and dictate in that way. But if you have a highly educated population that can think through problems, those are the people that are going to be more vocal about it,
right?
And offer problems moving forward,
right? So, explain to the audience. You call yourself a Black National Feminist. What is a Black National Feminist?
I think that I generally just call myself a Black feminist, right? And I think that. Nationalism might be implied in that definition because I think that by and large with a lot of versions of Black feminism, it's not as a stark kind of divide between, you know, it's not a battle of the sexes going, right? Like, so both Black women and Black men are under, like, the thumb of white patriarchal power, right? So
right.
I understand, that doesn't mean that Black men can't oppress Black women in certain sort of ways, but your access to white patriarchal power is different, right?
Right.
And so then, like, what I would be concerned with is, you know, making sure that all of us get what we need to be getting from this country, right? So, like, a lot of times with white feminism, there's, like, an easy sort of divide between, like, women and men, where men are the oppressors, and it's kind of more clear-cut like that, right? It's not as clear-cut for us, you know, whether we're in the United States or other places. And again, this doesn't mean that Black men can't oppress Black women. What I'm suggesting is having access to power with a big P is sometimes just as elusive for you as it is for me. So one of the questions that you had asked before was, like, you know, what sort of things should we be doing differently? I think that one of the things that I'm always curious about and think that we kind of fail a lot of times is not having sort of a holistic approach to what Black liberation looks like for us, right? And so a lot of times, like, through my whole, like, coming of age, you know, I came of age I would guess, like, in the 80s, right? So you were talking about, like, the crack epidemic.
Right.
And so the whole narrative, the national narrative around Black people was about, like, Black men being endangered species, right?
Right.
And that became, like, something that I heard so much of. And so a lot of my life was early on oriented to like uplifting black men, right? You know, when statistically speaking, you know, we fare just as bad as black men.
And it seems
like
the sisters were listening more than the brothers. It seems like the sisters were listening more than the brothers.
I don't know if it's as simple as that. I think that if you're thinking about like who gets to be like the ultimate criminal, that's black people, right? But black women get to be like, proportionately speaking, we're like the most dangerous of women, right? But you don't think of women as as dangerous as men, right? So,
well, they could be, y'all could be dangerous. Y'all could be dangerous. Y'all dangerous.
You know what I mean.
Y'all graduating at a higher rate. Y'all getting into the political realm. Y'all doing more for our culture than us. I mean, brothers, we're trying to catch up to you. Y'all being entrepreneurs, y'all writing, y'all this and y'all that. The identity piece, trying to work on self. The sisters are doing much more than us. And I had a show one time called "All Black Women Superheroes." And yes, you are, most definitely.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only going to see. I'm looking at with these women with my eyes, through my eyes and my spirit, my perception. We're trying to catch up. Press one if you have a comment or a question. I think you're intimidating these people, Dr. Brown. Go ahead. Continue. I'm sorry to interrupt
me?
You.
Little old me.
Little old me. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you this question. What's the difference between a black nationalist, the women of the black nationalist movement, versus the women of the civil rights movement, such as the NAACP, the Urban League? What's the difference between the two sisters, of the two thinking process?
I think that's kind of easy in the sense that if you're thinking about like people, women specifically, who would be in the NAACP versus women who would be in like, let's say, the Black Panther Party or So like when you're talking about black nationalism, you're talking a lot of times about a separatist movement, right? And so, and that's a different thing than thinking about like segregation, which is an imposed thing, rather than black people separating and building their own stuff, right? Whether we're talking about economics, politics, social organizations. And so the NAACP, by and large, is an integrationist. That's their pathway to power and struggle, right? But these other organizations who would be black nationalists are separatist movements, right? You know, so this is why you hear things like a nation within a nation. You know, like, so if you're not thinking like on a Garvey tip and you're trying to leave this place, you know, you are thinking about like creating like your own sort of black strongholds where you can create economic, political, and social power. So I think that's the easiest way that I could answer that.
Can we ever achieve that, gaining economic, political, and social power? Can we ever achieve this in America?
Wakanda. Wakanda is Amanda, you know. I mean, like, you know, you'll see pockets of that resonating. Like you were talking about the Nation of Islam, right? They used to have, you know, a couple of blocks, right, where they were doing their own canneries and fisheries and all sorts of things. So, you know, but by and large, you know, the government doesn't like these type of movements. You know, think about like MOVE in Philly. You know, like,
right,
like that's,
I remember that. They got bombed.
Yeah.
And it was a black mayor that did it. It was a black mayor that did it.
It was a black mayor that took the fall for it, which is the same thing.
Yeah.
He didn't have to do that, you know.
He didn't.
No. So I think that, I'm making jokes, but I'm thinking about, like, maroon colonies during slavery. I'm thinking about, a lot of people are moving towards discussing Afrofuturism because they're envisioning,
yes.
You know.
Yeah, that's a new wave. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Afrofuturism.
Yeah, but do I think that ever, blah, blah, blah? No, but this is one of the reasons why COVID has gotten me like a little crazy. I'm trapped here for right now. I can't even travel out of the country if I really, really wanted to without it being a big hassle. So,
According to these people, I think I asked you this earlier, but I'm going to redress it again once you go in more detail of according to the sisters, according to the divas, if they were asked this question, what would they say in general, the roadmap to liberation and freedom? What our roadmap should be? Specifically.
I didn't answer this fully enough for you before.
No. Specifically. Yeah, that's why I said specifically. We touched on
it. Okay. So one of the things that I talk about in my book, so like I use like these women as kind of case studies, right? Because they all kind of do different things, right? But there's like an overall sort of principle about like the Black aesthetic movement and what I'm arguing about decolonization that happens that they're tapping into. So there'd probably be about 9 points. What was I thinking? So the first thing, and this is coming from like the Black aesthetic movement and issues of decolonization, right? So the first thing that I say in my book is that the Black aesthetic movement or the Black arts movement, as you like to call it, marks a shift in the way double consciousness is perceived, right? So double consciousness, you understand that with Du Bois, really is about, managing sort of like the white gaze, right? And then white projections of blackness, right? With the Black arts movement, what you have is a shift away from the white audience to a Black audience. And that means that you are centering blackness within your own creative productions, right? And that's like the audience that you're prioritizing with your writing, right? So the other thing that I say is that it also means that you do like a collective unmasking of anger, right? Like, so if you think about like something like the slave narratives, right? In the slave narrative, the hardest thing to do is to depict anger, right? Because the slave narratives are, they're narratives, yes, but they're also like political documents, right? And so if you're a person who is a former slave and you're trying to convince white people that slavery is bad and wrong and evil, like if you seem angry about it, okay, so it's like a dance you have to do, right? If you're not angry, then people are like, oh, the darkies love working in the field. They like to whistle and they sing all the time. Slavery is great. They're just like one of the family, right? So you can't like not be angry. But if you're too angry, then you get like people being paranoid that if you did release enslaved blacks, then they would just run amok and kill all the white people, right? And so when you get fast forward and we're switching audiences now, you're no longer concerned about masking your anger, right? So you see like a lot of angry stuff and angry poetry that comes out of the 60s. And even before that, like if we're thinking about like the protest movement. Then you also see a lot of things. I think the third point would be this idea of a deconstruction of whiteness and counter-stereotyping. So a lot of times we make whiteness into like this omniscient thing, right? The man, it's like almost like a godlike sort of presence, right? But if you deconstruct whiteness and you do some counter-stereotyping, like you would think like, there's no like good way to stereotype, but the counter-stereotyping, we need something that happens so deep in the 60s, right, to shock us into a different way of thinking about blackness. So one kind of way of deconstructing whiteness and counter-stereotyping is thinking about notions of, like, difference being coded as subjective, right? Like, so normally black people or people of color are always the ones that are other and different, right? But a lot of things that are happening during the black aesthetic movement is pushing us away from that. The second sort of point about deconstruction of whiteness would be that the white subject, we deconstruct like whiteness because whiteness has this sort of like universal signifier. It acts as a universal signifier for like humanity. So people are challenging that, right? Like, so then we want to kind of like undermine notions of white privilege. We want to talk about how black people can see the self-actualization as possible even in the face of racist oppression. And then we also want to talk about deconstructing whiteness to allow for the possibility of appealing to or speaking to or creating alliances with other ethnic or racial minorities. And then I think like the final point would be, I'm thinking this is the final point, but let me do my mental Rolodex here. I think that the final point would be back to sort of like an idea of black nationalism with regards to like creating black and third world publishing houses and journals, you know, so creating sort of like a repository where black people who want to do something different don't have to rely on white gatekeepers to publish their materials.
Right. And not always rely on white instructors either. Take to that thought process. How can we communicate that to the neighborhood level, to the local communities? Like Baltimore, the Seventh Ward in D.C., you know, how can we get a regular person or for example, 72% of our families are headed by women. How can you take that process and put it in the minds of a regular working person?
Well, you know, damn if I know, you know, because I don't teach like regular working people, right? But what I do try to do with my own writing and my teaching is to make hard concepts more concrete for people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes like the barriers there are, I would say that sometimes for me when I'm out and about in the real world talking about stuff, is that people don't often like to critique their own pleasure. You know what I mean? Like, so something's happening and it's really messed up, but that person could like sing a good song. You might overlook the like the heinous, crazy stuff that they're doing. You know, I lost a hairdresser one time over Straight Outta Compton. You know, she got mad at me. And sometimes I just don't speak. I don't like to.
See, that's our culture. We cannot show how smart we are. We cannot express our opinions. If our concepts are different from what they see on media for white establishment, oh, something's wrong with us. As compared back to the 60s, to the time period that you talked about,
I think that
it was welcome. You were put in the front row. You were put in front of the mic. But today, the thoughts are antithetical to what's going on today. Why is that? Why we cannot speak about black nationalism? Why we can't speak about having our own? Why can't speak about having a black curriculum? How can we say, you hear this, you're too black?
So I think that like part of it is, so the real sort of thing, I wasn't afraid to speak to her about X, Y, and Z, but I needed to get my hair done, and that was, like, the primary concern, so I'm not trying to cause, you know, dissent up in the, you know, the hairdresser chair when I got to be out and about and in front of people. But where we, like, we didn't, so we had, like, it's about people not being able to critique their own pleasure. It's about not thinking that being smart is, like, cool or sexy. It's about a lot of different things, right? Like, so this woman is younger than I am, and, like, you know, like, I understood, like, I knew who NWA was, like, and I was just like, why didn't, you know, like, we're trying to make them into, like, civil rights leaders, and I don't know that I think that necessarily is the case. If I was making
my own case. Wish they won, you know. Somebody told me they said
like
NWA, women became the B word, and everybody became the N word.
Mm-hmm.
No, they were not
I
doing
think that.
Maybe individually they're doing something for their community as an individual, but they did change the hip hop game. And whatnot, and I'm talking about their lyrics. But however, if you want to talk about a group that represented Black power, Black liberation, I would think of a Public Enemy.
Here's like the thing. All right, this is where I'm going back to the idea of not being able to critique your own pleasure. You know, like, so she didn't necessarily grow up with NWA. Like, she doesn't know, like, all kinds of backstories that we might be privy to about that group. All she did was go see the movie, and she liked it. These people sponsored the movie. If I made a movie about myself, you know, like, you would think that I walked on water like Jesus Christ. So that's not really, you know what I mean? Like, so you have to
If I made a movie about myself, there would be so many dips. It would be like a roller coaster. It'd be so dips, ups, and downs, and whatnot. Make a movie about me, boy.
So back to what I was trying to sort of say with her, then I started, like, it was just a knee-jerk reaction. And I started, like, critiquing the movie, and I hadn't even really seen it. And I was right because, like, she was, you know, because I think that Hollywood is – very formulaic, so it's not that hard to predict certain sort of things, right?
Right.
And then she just got mad at me because, like, there wasn't really a way to refute that I was, like, right. She just got mad, right? And so, like, we teach that pleasure is more important than, like, critical thinking. All right? Like,
and it should be the other way around, correct? It should be the other way around,
I
right?
I think that people should be taught that there is pleasure in critical thinking, you know?
Right,
so,
yeah.
Like, if a person is trying to sort of, like, do, like, the okey-doke on me, I might know what's happening, and then I make a decision whether I speak on it or not, but I at least need to be awoke enough to understand that the okey-doke is happening. You know, like, it's like, so if you're asking me, like, how do we communicate this out to, like, regular people in the world, you know, we're in a pandemic. I can barely get my students to read the stuff that I want them to read without racial shaming and, like, having, like, a big old, like, hissy fit, you know, and acting crazy. So I've got, like, what, 2 more weeks of school left, counting this week here? I need a vacation. So what what I've been trying to do with my students that
I hear you. People don't know. But people don't realize being a professor is tough work. I mean, you always have to be reading. You always have to be writing. You always have to be teaching. People are going to challenge you what you're trying to convey to them. And you got to deal with the administration, the syllabus. You got to go. It's not a walk through the park. You just don't stand up there for You just don't stand up there and run your mouth for 2 hours for nothing. You know, you always have to research. It's research on top of research, writing on top of writing, and what have you. And you got to know what you're talking about.
Well, I think that what I've been trying to do with my students is to get them to understand why critical thinking is important. You know, and so like literature and film are the vehicles through which I push that, right, and model that for them. But like, again, you know, we're just in like a sticky moment where students are not really getting indoctrinated into like, you know, the etiquette of being in school. You know, so there's like a lot of hand-holding right now because you figure that, you know, with school is 4 years, two of them have been spent into a pandemic with people right now. So I have students that are doing crazy stuff. But I try to explain that even in this moment, critical thinking has been sort of soothing for me, right? Like it helps me understand, you know, like it demystifies how we get to where we are, you know? And so like, but like college itself is not the only sort of pathway to get people to critical thinking. So like there are people
not.
That I know.
Of course,
like
I think I personally I feel that we need more. Well, we used to have community workshops to talk about these issues, and I think community workshops that cover these issues that we're talking about this evening, you know, have moved away and had basically disappeared. You know, now everybody is like, I mean, last year during the pandemic. We're still in the pandemic. People doing Zoom and covering these issues. Now, as things die down, oh, we're not talking about them no more. And like, people, I know people that have been talking about these issues for 30 years. You know, so and they stay the course. They stay the course, and they continue to research and what have you. And I think. And I'm hopeful. I mean, we have an enemy that's very, very shrewd. And I'm hopeful that we're going to one day reach a point as a collective that we achieve the economics and political and social construct for us. I hope we achieve that. And I'm of the thought of the Black Nationalists. You know, I'm not big on the NAACP, even though, you know, they have good lawyers or what have you. I'm not really big on the Urban League or what have you, but they do have social programs in our community. You gotta give them that. You know, so we all have something to offer our community, but somehow we have to go back into the thinking of the mindset of Afrocentric thought. With a few minutes we have left, explain your other two books.
Well, my other two books are not published yet. They're works in progress. So I'm working on two books simultaneously. The first one that I'm working on is called Incognito Stances, Cross-Racial Espionage in Contemporary Literature and Film. And so I look at the...
Do you think it's a lot of espionage in our film industry with pertaining to Black folks?
Man, if you interrupt me one more time, I'm going to crawl through this phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know. But you've been saying so many things. I just want to... You say something, I just want to grab it and explain that piece. Yeah, I don't know nothing about that piece. Yeah, I never heard of espionage in film.
But the thing that I'm trying to get at is that, like, there are a lot of books that talk about racial passing, and so I'm talking about racial passing through the lens of this thing that I've developed called cross-racial espionage. And so I'm looking at people who are phenotypically white or black, who look white or black, but who are legally classified as, like, the other race. And instead of passing for individual gain, they pass for some sort of like subversive or egalitarian purpose rather than just for their own selves. So I'm looking at trying to kind of map out a collection of books and films that deal with it from that angle. And that's why it's called Incognito, you know, like a play on incognito.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second project is called Through Ebony Eyes. And I forgot what the second half of it's called because I change it all the time. But I'm really interested in one of the courses that I teach now is called Woke, W-O-K-E, Black Feminist Spectatorship. And so I'm really interested. This book is all about, like, how to read contemporary film or independent film or any film, really, with through an ethical, anti-racist, and feminist standpoint. And so in that class, I teach students how to do that.
Mm. Well, Dr. Brown, it has been a pleasure for you, having you on the show. I really enjoy our conversation. And I'd like to invite you back sometime in the future when you finish your other books.
Thank you. I would be really, really flattered to do that. I appreciate you having me on.
No problem. Okay, folks, that's another week. We made it through another week. And this is another pathway, an avenue that we should start thinking about our liberation in our communities, in our neighborhoods, and in our families, and within ourselves. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. Good night.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in.